So yesterday in our discussion group, we talked about the non-negotiables. Okay. So some of the non-negotiables may be Dharma things, our Dharma practice and so on. But very often our non-negotiables are our objects of attachment. And so what's behind something being an object of attachment is this feeling of I. There's a real me there, you know, solid, concrete. There are real other people or other objects there, solid and concrete. There's real happiness. And so there's this real I needs these real things or real people in order to get real happiness. And so this whole self-centered mechanism keeps going on and on and on. So it's very good, you know, when you take a look at your non-negotiables, and I think this is a discussion or a meditation we should do periodically, you know, because they change. And just watch how the sense of self is so intimately linked with our non-negotiables, and how that is a total the attachment we have for those things is a total setup for misery. Why? Because we cannot permanently stay near any next external person or thing. It's impossible. Why? Because anything that is created out of causes and conditions by its own nature is impermanent, changing moment by moment, ceasing moment by moment. So it's good, you know, when you see, when you're investigating those non-negotiables, to ask yourself, what am I doing in preparation to get all my non-negotiables? So what do I do to get them? What do I do to protect them so I keep on having them? Okay, and we'll see that we've put a lot of effort into getting them and into protecting them. And then the next question is, how much effort have I put into preparing myself for separating from them? Mm-hmm. And we'll usually realize that we've had zero effort in preparing our mind to separate from them. Because we think they're permanent, we want them to last forever. And so in not preparing for the separation, you know, this is a double whammy preparation for suffering, isn't it? Because separation's going to happen. So it's very good, you know, if you see that you're holding on to certain objects, certain status, certain self-image, certain people, as important in your life, to consider how are you going to prepare your mind for separating from them? Okay, for either the relationship changing, in which case you are not in accord the way you are now, or for their dying, or for your dying. You know, have we thought about the death of our loved ones and how we're going to handle that? Have we thought about our own death when we separate from them? And we may have a nice little program all set out about who's going to die first and who's going to die second, and nice little visualized scenes of, you know, touching bedside goodbyes. But death doesn't happen according to our wishful thinking. You know, it happens whammo, out of the blue. And so just to consider, you know, how much have we prepared for the separation from our non-negotiables? And then we realize that actually our non-negotiables, by their nature, are negotiable. So that's quite important. It's also the sense of I that comes up a lot in community life as we're trying to live together. And this whole program that we're doing is not just, you know, our morning teachings and the afternoon discussion, but it's the whole experience of living together and what comes up. And so to watch how the eye functions while you're living together with other people. This has come up a little bit in our discussions so far when the eye says, I don't like to be told what to do. Thank you very much. You know, don't tell me what to do. I will decide what I'm going to do. I am an adult and I've handled my life my whole time, and just don't tell me what to do. Okay, that's when we're being polite. We know how it manifests when we're not feeling so polite. Okay, so look at that sense of I that comes up, you know, about don't tell me what to do. Look at the sense of I that that likes to just relax, that, you know, the I that knows that we're at a monastery and that yet acts like we're at a summer resort. Yeah? And so what's that I doing that is, you know, the people who live here know I repeatedly have to say this, you know, this is an abbey, this is a monastery. Not a Dharma center, it's not a retreat center, it's not a summer resort, it's not a winter resort, you know. And so to look at the mind that goes into that mode, that is seeking pleasure, that transforms the environment into the resort that we want to be at. Look at the I that gets defensive when somebody says, oh, is this a summer resort? Or the eye that gets defensive, you know, that reminds us of what our behavior at a monastery should be. You know, that our behavior at a monastery is different than our behavior at a resort or a hotel. Okay? So just be aware of how that eye functions and how it comes up so readily. And it's quite fascinating. How quickly we want to explain what was really going on. Yeah, isn't it? Yeah. No, I really wasn't acting like a total jerk. You see, there were these reasons. And it was his fault. You know? And it's just quite interesting to watch how that comes out. And so in monastic life, you know, this is what the advantage of living together in community is, that this stuff starts to come up and we start to look at it and we look at our habits. You know, we see the habit of defending ourselves, how we instantly go into defensive mode, or how we instantly go into blame mode. Yeah, anything so that we look good, because we don't want to look bad. We don't want to lose face. We want to have a good reputation. We only want to hear nice words. So, you know, when you begin to watch, you see all the Lamrim meditations just tied up in one little event that happens during the day, don't you? You know, you can see the eight worldly concerns, you can see karma, you can see the disadvantages of suffering and how the afflictions arise and operate. You know, you can see the object of negation in the emptiness meditation. You can see the disadvantages of self-centeredness. Okay, so it kind of all comes up in daily life, our own personal Lamrim meditation. The thing is, we would much rather have it in a nice place like this, you know, where the discussion is to the whole group, not to us personally. Yeah. But I think this is all part of the practice, and knowing that we're all in it together, and knowing that we're all going to bungle it. Okay. Yeah, then that's a given. We're all going to blow it. We're all going to make mistakes, including me, especially me. You know, and to know that, and so not to get caught in this shame mode of, uh-oh, I got caught. Not to get caught in this self-hatred mode of, uh-oh, I blew it, I'm a failure. Okay, but just to accept that this happens and it's an opportunity to grow. And similarly, not to get caught in the, oh, you did that, you know, judgment of other people mode. Okay, so, you know, just to be aware of all of that and to realize there's no need for the defense of this. There's no need for the self-hatred. There's no need to compare ourselves with other people and make ourselves better or make ourselves worse. You know, that we're all in this whole thing together and learning from each other. Okay? And so we all have different things that are our weaknesses and different things that are our strengths, and we just work with it. And so in that way, you know, we have some compassion for ourselves, and we also have some compassion for each other, and so that stops the judgmental mind, okay? And it stops the opinion factory. Yeah, some of you have heard me talk about the opinion factory. Yeah, it's the factory inside here that works overtime, 25/8. Okay, ever need an opinion, ask me. I have lots of them, and they're free. Well, I won't give you as many of them as you don't want to ask. Okay, so just to become aware of our opinion factory, and since we're, you know, in the economy, so many are getting laid off, we can lay off part of our opinion factory, okay, and put it out of business. Okay. It's also interesting in this way, in living in community and living in a more structured environment, how the mind says, I want. Okay, you might have noticed that. You know, I want this. Now, why don't they have X, Y, and Z for breakfast? Now, why do they have this stuff? Now, why is the schedule done this way? Now, why is this happening that way? Because I want da 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 da. And so it's quite interesting to watch the I want mind. I was thinking a little bit more about Nancy's question at lunch yesterday about why Lama had, you know, talked about the Sangha working. Okay. And like I explained, it was very much, I think, to prevent this mind that says, I want, I deserve, you know. I've renounced, so now you should think that I'm so brave for renouncing and offer me everything I want, okay? Or you should take care of me, or you should do this, or you should do that. And Lama's, I remember very strictly, very clearly, this was like, you know, one of those, one of my friends calls them a Kodak moment. Something that is in your memory forever. Of Lama sitting in the, some of you have been to Tushita in the meditation room, the little window, bay window used to be the seat where the Lama sat. And him sitting there with his mala in his hand, you know, giving it to us, you know, because we had been behaving so well. And he had his mala in his hand. He said, you, every day, your mantra, if you're ordained, your mantra is, I am the servant of others. I am the servant of others. I am the servant of others. And he clicked his beads, you know. Mm-hmm. I am the servant of others. I am the servant of others. I am the servant of others. And so that's the mentality to have. Okay? So the way the Buddha set it up, you know, the monastics are the servant of others in the sense of upholding the teachings, becoming teachers, becoming good examples, doing spiritual counseling, helping people get, you know, with their problems and helping them get out of samsara. And so that's the gift of the Dharma. That's the way the monastic community serves. The lay community, you know, creates merit and serves by providing requisites, food, medicine, shelter, clothing. Okay? The monastics do not demand these things. Okay? The way the Buddha set it up is you have your alms bowl, and when you go on Pindapat in the morning with your alms bowl, you keep your eyes down. And you don't even ask. You just stand there with your alms bowl. And some people will put something in it and some people won't. And your job is to cultivate contentment and a sense of gratitude for the people who do put something in it. Okay. So, you know, it's that sense of contentment that we're trying to create here at the Abbey, even though we don't go on Pindapat, and even though you aren't monastics, you're living in, you know, a monastic community, to create that sense of contentment and gratitude. And so if something runs out before, you know, we don't call the lay people and say, oh, I need carrots, you know, give me more carrots. Or we need this, or we need that, or bring this, or bring that. That's not our job, okay? The way it's set up here at the Abbey is that, you know, the lay people have offered to, well, some lay people, like you know yourselves, have brought food when you come. And then some people in the neighboring community will have offered to do some shopping from money that has been donated, and so we all eat on that money that has been donated. Okay? But, and they say to us, give us a shopping list, which we may do once a week. Okay? But if something runs out, we do without that thing. Yeah? And, we don't just run into town to get it or call them up and say, you know, Bring the chocolate chip cookies or SAP, or, you know, bring the carrots or bring the whatever. Okay? So all this is part of our practice, you know, learning to be content, learning to see that actually it's very possible to be happy when all the things we thought were non-negotiable aren't available. And even when some of the things we thought were negotiable, you know, our mind throws temper tantrums when we don't have them. And we can see that, well, actually it's possible to live without some of those things too. Okay? So, you know, you take this as a kind of practice, everything that happens as a kind of practice. When I was went to Taiwan to take full ordination, you know, they just, you have no choice about the food that you're given, and you have to eat everything that is put on your plate, and there's quite an elaborate ritual for arranging the plates. So the first day I was there, I couldn't go eat because I didn't know how to do the ritual. I didn't know how to eat properly, so somebody brought me food to the room till I learned how to arrange the dishes and do all of that. And I was just learning to eat with chopsticks at that time. There was another American nun. She and I sat next to each other, and I think I was a little bit better at the chopsticks than her even, and I wasn't very good. And I remember they served pickles for breakfast. I can't stand pickles. You know, but okay. You know, and then rice all the time, which I have some difficulty with. And, you know, we couldn't eat very fast because we were eating with these chopsticks. So, and if you had to have finished your first portion before you put your bowl on the far side of the table, because then they would walk by and, you know, give seconds. And so we often weren't there in time. If we were, then we couldn't finish it in time to be ready for when the dedication was. But you know, this was just part of your training. This was just it. And it was very interesting, you know, sometimes to watch the mind kind of saying, oh, it would be so nice to have this, or oh, it would be so nice to have that, or oh, I'm glad they're having this today, or I'm glad they're having that, you know. Now watch the attachment to food come up. You know, so you watch the eye then. But that was okay. You know, that wasn't too difficult. Then, one day, and there's like, I think there are maybe 550 people at my ordination, you know, because those days they gave the ordination once a year. We all came to one temple, huge dining room, you know, and we all ate together. And so one day, you know, in the middle of breakfast, just starting breakfast, the whole room silent. And the door opens and two nuns come in with these trays with cornflakes. All this kind of Western food. They come over, apparently they had noticed that we were losing weight. They came over and put these two trays in front of each of us. Well, if I ever had any doubt about the object of negation, it was there so big. I was so embarrassed. I felt like I just wished I had the magic power to disappear at that moment, because 550 people, all of them are going through the same difficulty we are, you know, just learning everything, and maybe they didn't like the food as well, although it was Chinese food, you know, they were used to it, but I'm sure it's, you know, it's never exactly the way you want. And then all of a sudden, two of us are singled out for special attention. And I just wanted to really just crawl under the table and pretend I didn't exist. I'm so embarrassed. So, you know, it's just very interesting, you know, just to see how the object of negation arises during daily life. You know, how when you don't have what you want, the object of negation is there, and then when you get what you want, the object of negation is also there. So, that was quite interesting. Now, as all eyes turned to the two of us. Oh. So, anyway, you know, this is how we work with things, is they come up in our daily life. Yeah? And so I say this just as a little bit of advance warning. Maybe it's already happened. Okay. Oh, along that line, you know, that whole thing of negotiating And, you know, you see very vividly how we want to negotiate so we can have samsara and nirvana at the same time. Do you see that? Yeah? How our mind is always negotiating. We want the best of samsara, and we also want to do our dharma practice. Okay? So we don't want to go on any kind of ascetic trip, because remember, the Buddha tried that. Okay? He tried that and he realized that extreme asceticism doesn't work. Okay? But extreme self-indulgence doesn't work either, so we have to have some middle way. But it's very interesting how we develop all sorts of reasons and ways of putting the Dharma together so that we have everything that we want. You know, the Dharma and our samsaric pleasures. Mm-hmm. And some of you who are living here may remember, you know, because I sometimes share the different emails that I get. And recently there was a series of an email exchange between one woman who actually, and this kind of email I get quite often, somebody who wants to be a nun but you know, needs to continue working and doesn't, you know, wants to be around a monastic but wants to keep living in their usual family environment or in their usual comfortable environment. And so this woman was, you know, I mean, she was asking sincerely, and she didn't understand the Vinaya very well, but I had to explain it several times in increasing levels of directness. That, you know, there's monastic life and there's low life, and they're different. She was proposing something that was called, actually her first email wanted to be a lay monastic. You know, what do you do for lay, you know, I want to be a lay monastic. And I said, there isn't such a thing. No. I've also seen one website, you know, one teacher who calls himself a lay monastic. Mm-hmm. And I wrote him, there isn't such a thing. But people would like that, you know, had to have all the comforts of samsara, and plus the Dharma practice, and not really, you know, have to give up the attachments. And that is, you know, it doesn't work very well. Now, because when we're very busy trying to get and protect our objects of attachment, we become very distracted from our Dharma practice. Okay, that doesn't mean we, you know, slam down things and say, oh, I'm not going to have any broccoli because I'm so attached to broccoli. You know, and go on some big trip and deny ourselves broccoli. I mean, come on, we got to eat. And if broccoli is served for lunch, you eat broccoli. Okay, and you work with your mind. You know, so we don't want to go on some big, big self-denial, self-deprecation trip. That's not very healthy, okay? But to look out for the mind that wants to make sure we're comfortable all the time, that we get what we want, okay? And, you know, this woman was putting forth very good arguments. You know, she said if there were lay nuns, then these lay nuns could work at a job and they would have some savings so that they could help out the Tibetan nuns. Yeah, it sounds very good, doesn't it? Yeah, you earn some money, then you have more money to give to the monastics. But what's the difference then between being a lay follower and a monastic, if that's what you want to do? Is have your living so that you can give, donate, earn money and, you know, take care of yourself and make donations. There's no reason to become a monastic in order to do that. And I said, what, you know, if that lifestyle becomes what's called monastic, then what about the rest of us?
We're monastics. What are we get called?
You know, I think that, you know, we had gotten deleted from the picture. Yeah. And so, you know, there's a difference. There's monastic lifestyle and there's lay lifestyle. And that's why it's called leaving, it's called leaving the home, you know, or leaving the householder life, or going into homelessness. Yeah. And it's called that for a particular reason, because you are leaving the householder life and the home life. Okay? So it doesn't just mean moving out of your home into an apartment. It's like everything that goes along with having a home. Yeah? So eating what we want when we want to eat it, doing what we want when we want to do it, having all the people we love all around us that we can spend time with and never be separated from. Having a nice, comfortable life with all the things that we think we need to be happy. And in the time of the Buddha, you know, I mean, what could you think of to be happy? You know, maybe a bigger bed or, you know, more luxurious bed or something like that. Now we have so many things we need to be happy, don't we? Yeah, we need a can opener. We need, you know, new computer stuff. We need a rototiller. We need, you know, blankets that aren't scratchy. We need this. We need that. I mean, our list of things to make ourselves comfortable is, we have much more variety than we want, don't we? And, you know, and we just go for it. So, you know, the whole thing of simplicity and lifestyle is very, very important. And that's hard to do, you know, in today's day and age, even if you're a monastic sometimes, because people give you so many things. I had it happen in Seattle that one person wanted to give me a television. And I said, thank you, but no, I don't want a television. And I said, you know, how about using the money and giving it to the Tibetan nuns or something? And she said, no, I really want to give you a television. You know? And I said, well, thank you, but I have to decline. You know, it really becomes sometimes very, very hard. And that one I was very, sometimes, you know, with bodhisattva vows, you have to accept so that people could have the chance to accumulate merit. But then it's so easy, they give you what you don't need, and all of a sudden you start thinking you need it. And you don't want to separate from it. Okay? And so, you know, it's hard, and that's why I think it's really important, you know, as individuals and as a community, that we keep going through our closets and giving away the things that we don't need and the things that we don't use, even if other people, you know, have given them to us. If we use them, yes, then they're valuable. We definitely keep them. Okay? But the simplicity in lifestyle is something that's important. Okay? And so you see that even by the dress code. You know, all of you are wearing your t-shirts inside out so that all the logos don't show. You know, except your Shravasti Abbey t-shirt. That's the one kosher one. You know, but why? Because we create an identity depending, you know, on our t-shirts. And it's distracting, isn't it? Everybody goes around reading everybody else's t-shirt logos and what they say and what you're supposed to buy and stuff like that, you know. That's the reason we ask people, you know, solid color clothing and modest clothing and so on and so forth. Okay? So all this, you know, it fits together and it's all done for a certain purpose, you know, to train the mind. That wasn't what I was going to talk about today. I'll get into some of these things more, you know, as time goes on, some of the values or principles of monastic life and how we try and put them into practice. Yeah. But maybe this was just a little introduction to get us started at looking at things. Okay, and I'm working at this too, because I'm sure, you know, everybody who knows me well, you know, knows that sometimes I come in the kitchen and, oh, there's none of this? Where is that today at lunch? You know, I thought we had a lot of it. Okay, so we're all working on this. And it's just something to be mindful of. And that to be aware that samsara and nirvana are opposites. Okay. So to give up the mind that's trying to structure everything so we have exactly what we want, and instead develop the mind that is content with what we have. Because if we have the mind that's content with what we have, then no matter what we have happiness. Yeah. Whereas if the mind is always trying to manipulate the environment so we get what we want, then we spend a lot of time doing things that aren't very valuable, and we never succeed in getting everything that we want, because, you know, what we want is endless. Beginningless and endless, like samsara. Actually, samsara ends, but our wants don't end. Okay. Any questions about that so far? Yeah?
I think that in the past, I think after Bodhisattva retreat, I somewhat came to realize that I guess I didn't really know what I was going to be, how the situation here as far as living in structure with your heart doctor. I had a sense because you had spoken about it. And I think after Vajrasattva, and then I went to Seattle and I realized, you know, there was a lot of understanding that I hadn't quite severed as completely as I had thought. The things mm-hmm. that I loved and cherished and all those things about city life and friendship that when I moved in my mind, I thought I had really made a clean cut. It really felt good. It felt joyous. I felt, you know, much more safe. And in the past 5 months, I suddenly realized that I'm still going through the process of letting go of all those attachments,
mm-hmm.
particularly to friends and particularly mm-hmm. to a little house on the street with everybody, you know, friendly and the independence of being able to get in my car and go wherever I want. But I had kind of had in my mind this understanding that I'd already done that. And when I got all that nervous, kind of fidgeting, restless energy a few months ago, I think it was part of just getting in touch mm-hmm. with how that I was still kind of in the between place between living in community here and my 35 years of being an independent woman, no partners, no children, being able to come and go as I pleased.
Mm-hmm.
Really a strong habituation in my mm-hmm. thinking. And having to realize how strong that is in a time
right.
that really kind of pushes up against mm-hmm. the interest of the whole and the interest of the one do butt heads quite strongly. And it's been here in the past 2 months.
Yeah. And you know, that struggle you described, you know, thinking that you had let it all go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Those of us who have been around know that, you know, and I think I might have said even at the beginning that the same issues keep coming up again and again, except you go through them at deeper and deeper levels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so expect that. Yeah, and so, you know, this whole talk is not a thing of, okay, by, you know, a week from Friday you have to let go of all your attachments. That's not the way it works. I mean, this is a process that takes a lot of time. But what monastic life is, it's a willingness to face that. And it's a willingness to work with the attachments and or work against the attachment in our own mind. Okay? So it's an ongoing process. It's not that you've conquered it all and then you take vows. It's your vows help you to conquer it because you've decided that you want to deal with that. And so you see the structure of the precepts as helping you to, because you make this decision, I'm not going to do that. Okay, and then when it comes up again, you've already made the decision, and so you don't have to think about it. So you begin to see, I can live without it. So things like entertainment, for example. Okay, so one of the vows is not to have entertainment. So if you really think about this and you see entertainment as, you know, and remember, entertainment doesn't mean, abandoning entertainment doesn't mean that you're solemn all the time. I mean, you watch documentaries, you can still keep up with what's happening in the world, but you're not glued to the computer screen or the TV screen or watching all the latest movies or, you know, knowing all the latest songs or whatever. But you know, you've done some introspection and you decide that, you know, I'm just using entertainment. It could be any one of the number of things, you know, isn't the way you want to go, and you know you're attached to it, and you know that you don't want to, you want to work with that and not just immediately give in. And you also know that if you take a precept in the presence of the Buddha, that it helps give you that confidence to come back to your own wisdom, which has decided that you don't want to do that. And so you take the precept, and then when the opportunity comes up for entertainment, and your friends are saying, oh, please come and do this and that, you know, it's, well, I've already decided that doesn't work. I've made a pledge in the presence of the Buddha. I'm so sorry. I'm not going to go. And your mind doesn't need to get confused about should I do it or shouldn't I do it, you know, because you've thought about it already and already decided what you're going to do. So the same happens in terms of, you know, drugs and alcohol. The same thing happens in terms of sex. The same thing happens in terms of, you know, icky, gooey, sticky emotional relationships. So, you know, it's just we take the precepts because they help give us the internal confidence and the external structure, so that instead of just following the attachment, we're able to step back from it. But, you know, it's an ongoing project working with this. Yeah. So don't think that it's, don't think, okay, I gotta have it all conquered before I take vows, because that's not it. Okay. You know, you work on it as you ordain. But don't think, oh, well, she said I don't have to have it all conquered before I take vows, and I can continue working with it after I take vows, so I can continue doing these things, you know, after I take vows and just keep working on it. Well, no, it's not exactly like that. Okay. We need some kind of a certain degree of confidence that we can keep the vows. Otherwise, it's not beneficial to take them, you know. Or if you've already bargained the vows down to, you know, well, celibacy just means I don't get married, but, you know, I can sleep with people outside of marriage, and that's my definition of celibacy, you know. No, that's not it. You know, or, you know, this one means this or this one means that. Then there's other, you know, there's certain things like, you know, there's a precept to not eat after midday. Okay, and you're all going to go, well, she eats after midday. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for the first 5 years of my ordination, I didn't. And then ran into some difficulties, and I consulted my teachers, and I got permission to eat in the evening, and I do my best to try and remember it's a medicine meal and not to eat out of attachment, and, you know, do some confession. And so there's some things that you have to adjust, but you have to be careful about which ones you adjust and how you adjust it. Now, there's another precept to only bathe twice a month. I've adjusted that one. You know, for your benefit. So, yeah, there are certain things that where you, you know, where there's, you know, the adjustments have to be made for different reasons. Okay? Okay, so actually, what I was going to talk about today, before I get into all of this, are there any questions? More questions about this? Yeah.
Well, the struggle that I have, and it's been going on a while, is about the Nirvana Samsara combo. But it's that actually, as I go on retreats and get teachings and then go back in the world, things seem to go a lot smoother there. Like, you know, my anger is more subsided and communications with people I'm close to seem to go better and breakthroughs happen. And so, you know, do you see where I'm going? It gets confusing.
Samsara's nicer.
Samsara is nicer.
Yeah.
I'm going, what's that about?
Okay. So what you're saying is that you go on retreats and you have weekly teachings or whatever.
Yeah,
you work on your mind.
Yeah,
it changes you.
Yeah.
And so when you go back into your family, you know, your relationship with your family is better, with your colleagues is better, you feel much better, so samsara is going better. And so, yes, dharma is very good because it helps my mind and my samsara goes better. And see here, this is where we have to look at what our motivation is. Because it's true, our samsara will go better as we practice the Dharma. And part of my observation with Buddhism spreading in the West, and I think it was probably similar in ancient India and in Tibetan culture too, is that people come to the Dharma very often because they have a lot of suffering in their lives. And they're looking for techniques that will help them deal with their present level of suffering. And the Dharma does give you those techniques to deal with your anger and feelings of failure and loneliness and da-da-da. And so what happens is if you come to the Dharma with that motivation, that, you know, I have some suffering of this life, and then the Dharma helps you with that motivation, you know, fulfill that motivation, then you feel satisfied, and I've noticed that those people, after a while, then they don't come to the Dharma Center as much, because they got what they were looking at for, their samsara was better, you know, they kind of lose interest, they say, you know, I'm just hearing the same teachings over and over again, or you're pushing me to you know, it's Dharma's pushing me too much or something. And what you see there is that the person, their level of, the motivation they had for coming in the first place was how to make my present life smoother and easier and simpler and more peaceful. And they got that. But they didn't have the motivation for liberation. Okay, and that's why they stopped coming. They didn't have the motivation for enlightenment, and so that's why they stopped coming. Yeah, so the Dharma fulfill their needs, and that's good, and they don't create negative karma by doing some of their old negative habits anymore. But they're not really able to go to the depth of the Dharma because they weren't motivated for it. You know? And so that's why the motivation to take ordination, the minimum level motivation, is a wish to be free of cyclic existence. Yeah? It's not a wish to be comfortable. Yeah? And that's where I was talking, you know, the other day about some of the standards that the Buddha set down different standards for accepting people into the Sangha, but then how different traditions look at that also. You know, and I was saying how in the Chinese tradition, you know, there's the thing, if you know somebody gets old and, you know, I mean, everybody has different hindrances. When you're young, your hindrance is, you know, you want sex and you want an intimate relationship. You know, you're not really so worried about money and stuff like that. When you're old, you know, sex, you know, forget it. I want to make sure my old age is secure. Okay, and so different people, you know, what we're attached to at different times of our life is going to change according to the age of our body. But anyway, so in the Chinese communities, you know, they say, oh, well, you know, the husband's died, everything's, you know, kids are grown up, and so then people want to come to the monasteries to ordain, and it's just comfortable for them there, and they create, you know, they create some merit, but they're old, and so they, you know, they can't do much, or they don't expect to have to do much, and you know, they don't really want to train, they just want a place to live out their old age, and so they don't usually accept those people. In the Tibetan culture, you know, they'll let anybody ordain, you know, and so many times people like this do ordain, and then they usually live at home, and you know, sometimes, you know, with their children, or sometimes together with other older nuns or whatever. You know, they have different kind of standards. Catholic nuns generally, you know, don't do it. So, you know, different cultures have different standards about this. But the thing that what I'm getting at is to look at the mind, okay? And the Tibetans just say, oh, well, even if somebody's just looking for a comfortable old age, still they create merit by keeping the vows, and that's good for them. Okay, whereas the Chinese look at the benefit for the whole Sangha community and the impact it has on the community and how the community looks in the eyes of the lay people. And so they use that kind of standard. You know, that doesn't mean, I'm sure that there's some people who are older and have raised their families and really have genuine renunciation, but you know, it's kind of, there's different people who, you know, you have to look individually here. It was very touching when I was in 1998, I was invited to be part of the Bhikshuni Sangha that was giving the Bhikshuni vows in Bodh Gaya. And they had, you know, there were a lot of, it was sponsored by a Chinese organization, so there were a lot of Chinese nuns, and there were some Theravada nuns, you know, about 20 nuns from Sri Lanka, and about 11 Western nuns, and then there was a group of nuns from somewhere in central India. I forget exactly where. I'm not sure if it's maybe Maharashtra, and they wear dark brown robes. They follow the Theravada tradition, and most of them were very, very poor, you know. And Lakshay Soma, bless her heart, arranged for most of them to get new robes when they finally got to Bodh Gaya. And they had, I don't know what level of vows they had before, probably just 8 precepts, because it was Theravada. And they came and they wanted to take the Bhikshuni vows. And there was one of the nuns, she had been, I don't know how long she had been ordained. She was quite old, but she had been ordained, you know, as a in their tradition for quite a number of years. And the old master didn't want to give her the precepts because she was so old. And, you know, he just had this concern. And she said, I'm going to kill myself if you don't give me the precepts. I mean, this woman had incredible renunciation. I mean, I don't think she really would have killed herself, because I hope she would have understood something about karma. But, you know, she just was like so determined. And she went through this whole program. I forget how long the program was. Maybe a couple of weeks. And it involves a lot of bowing, and it's hot in Bodh Gaya, and, you know, the whole schedule and the whole thing. And I remember standing in the back of the room, because some of us would kind of, you know, supervise a little bit, and watching her do her bowing, and, like, you know, with so much difficulty, and she had her cane going up and down the steps of this, but she had renunciation, you know. I mean, she really wanted to do this. So, That was a long answer to your short question. But, you know, to get back to it, yes, Dharma does help in the present life. And sometimes when we receive that help, then we feel more comfortable and we say, Dharma's good and that's my level of practice and that's great. But, you know, those people don't have the renunciation of cyclic existence. Yeah. And that's fine, Dharma still benefits them. But I think we do need to still keep clear, you know, what's the actual motivation for monastic life. And also, you know, because I think there's a tendency towards what I've termed Dharma light. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And, you know, kind of feel-good Dharma. And there's a lot of that, and many people are satisfied by it. And on one hand, it's very good because the good imprints are put in their mind and they have their life benefits and they, you know, they create less negative karma and so on and so forth. But, you know, maybe not getting the complete teachings or having the full motivation. And even when we do have renunciation, you know, to a certain degree, if we look at our minds, we don't have renunciation 24 hours of the day. You know, kind of renunciation comes maybe, you know, for a split second periodically when we're in retreat. Well, but at least we have some intellectual renunciation or some level of renunciation. It's not the kind that Jay Rinpoche is talking about in the three principal aspects of the path. We haven't gotten there yet, but we have some renunciation, and that's enough to take the ordination. Mm. Yeah. So don't think that you have to be great yogi with 24-hour renunciation, because it takes some time to build up to that. As we keep working through, you know, the attachment to, you know, chocolate chips and the attachment to this and the attachment to that, and watch how our mind gloms on to the most insignificant thing and makes an incredible big deal out of it. Any other questions?
I have a question about requisites and accepting things from lay people in the protocol, because, you know, as Bodhisattva vow says, if somebody offers you, you have to accept it. I have a situation that might come up for other people, and it's confusing. Like, I have a friend, and he tries to offer me a lot of things, and he did that even when I was a lay person. Like, in retreat, he wanted to send me socks and long underwear and all this stuff, and he continues to do it. But then often it's more than what I need, mm-hmm. so I will give it to another monastic, feeling mm-hmm. like I need to accept from him so he can create merit, you know, and not say, thank you very much, I have enough, or sometimes I do it and he insists anyway. But then I find that, like, years later he'll check, like, what did you ever do with that sweater? I think you'll never see me wearing it or something. And so now, like, for instance, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to see him again, and I know he's going to start offering all this stuff, and then he's going to say, what happened to those little socks, which I ended up giving to Tenzin over in Omak, you know, and all the long underwear that I gave to Venerable John and Tenzin, because they're my size, and I had more than enough. And so I'm kind of going through this thing of, like, I don't want to accept any more from him, because I don't want him to go through this quiz every time I see him. But I don't want him to, you know, create negative mind and think I'm, like, dissing his offering. And what's he doing?
Okay, so in the case with, like, where you accept, I repeat it for the benefit of the you know, as a monastic where you're getting offered more than you really need, and according to Bodhisattva vows, you accept it if it's something allowable for you to accept. If they're offering you liquor or, you know, things like that, you don't accept. Something allowable to accept. But then afterwards, you know, you give it to somebody else, but then the benefactor comes and says, whatever happens, you know, you're not wearing it or you're not using it. I gave you, what do you do? I think that then, I mean, then it's the opportunity for the benefactor to check if the offering was freely given, mm-hmm. or if there were strings attached to it. And I think from our side, we can simply say, you know, thank you so much. You gave the offering out of incredible kindness. I had more than I need. There were other people who didn't have these, and so I shared it with them. But I really do appreciate your kindness. Because I think often when people check up on us, what they're wanting, they may just want confirmation that we do see mm-hmm. what they did for us as an act of kindness. Mm-hmm. We do feel that link with them. Mm-hmm. You know, I really appreciate your generosity, but I only have one body and I can't use 24 pairs of socks. You know, I don't have that many things. And so I share it with others and, you know, it's put to good use. So I think to reassure, you know, and I think it's very good that you gave it to other monastics, mm-hmm. you know, because one of the things is, you know, receiving donations because you're a monastic and then giving it to your family because you're mm-hmm. attached to them, that's not good. That creates a lot of negative karma. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you don't use donations given to you because you're a monastic to give to the people that you're attached to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I had a very big lesson about that many years ago with Rinpoche, where I had... you know, and if it comes up, you know, sometime when you're talking about generosity, you can explain this, you know, about the motivation, the purity of the motivation and all. But I had wanted to give Rinpoche some brocade book covers, you know, because it looked like he needed book covers. And so I went into Armsala and I got some brocade and I sewed it by hand, you know, because I couldn't afford to go to the... I was very poor when I lived in India, and so I sewed it all by hand and made it all, and it was very beautiful and everything. And, and so... and so I went in with these beautiful, you know, brocade book covers, you know, and offered them to Rinpoche, and he said thank you, and my interview was over, and I left, and then guess you know, Genchampa Wangdu walked in, you know, to see Rinpoche after that, and then when Genchampa Wangdu leaves, I'm out in the yard, and he's carrying the book cover. Because I was giving them to him, you know, and then it was all of a sudden, my Ashley! And then I realized, no, you know, the merit is created in the giving. And once it's given, it no longer belongs to me. You know, when I give, it no longer belongs to me. It belongs to the other person, and they're free to do with it as, you know, they wish. Yeah.
I have kind of a question on that same note. So uh-huh. in this process of getting rid of a bunch of stuff that I have, mm-hmm. And having very close family and friends that, of course, over the years have given me things, mm-hmm. Do you have any advice on, I mean, it's pretty evident when I'm giving away very, quote-unquote, special things,
yeah.
you know, that have memories attached to them and whatever, I'm okay with it, but... do you have any advice on how to explain it?
They may not be. Yes, I am.
Yeah.
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 Marcia,
yeah.
My advice is to give it away.
Mm-hmm.
Find out what they're attached to and give it back to the people who are attached to it. I didn't realize that. I just wasn't wired that way. I have created a number of difficulties and unhappiness in my family, especially with my parents around that, especially my mom. It's taken about 4 months for her not to every interaction, every email, every time we talk, bring up an object. Yeah, because from their side, you know, they're trying to give their kids the best in the world.
Yeah.
You know, and so they, for them, and especially my parents, it's very much a material thing, you know. This is what they really had to give us when we were kids, even too. They were very supportive mm-hmm. materially. They didn't really know how to do support in other ways. And so it's a slap in the face, almost, I think. And I talked to Barbara McDaniel about this and some of my friends at work who just get it naturally. I mean, they, of course you don't give away family things to... But it was really, I wouldn't do it again the same way at all.
Yeah.
Partly it was laziness on my side. I didn't want to deal with mailing all this stuff.
But I carefully gave things away. I was very careful because I knew that they were important. But I didn't realize that the people that give them, I think it's some family thing. It's better just to at least communicate, would you like this back? It would save you a lot of trouble too.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's very good. Like you said, just to say, you know, would you like it back? And then they can say yes or no. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing sometimes the things people are attached to that we can't imagine that they would be attached to. Yeah. But then it's also interesting to see what happens. Like the two vases on an altar over there, they were offered to the Abbey by one woman who used to live in Boise. She now lives on the East Coast. And when she gave them to me, she said that this was a gift from her, they're from Korea, from her father to her mother.
Mm.
I think either before they were married or early on in the marriage. And she had never met her father. You know, he had, I guess, been killed or whatever. So they were obviously something quite meaningful. But she, and they did belong to her, you know, but she offered them to the Abbey. And I was very, very touched that she gave something that was so meaningful to her personally to us. And so I feel very good about, you know, we use them, we put things in them and use them as offering vases. And, you know, and I kind of think of her and dedicate for her, you know, and her parents' benefit. So, you know, sometimes it's, my parents one time when I was there, I was saying how we needed some tablecloths and they gave to the Abbey, my mom pulled out one tablecloth that had been their wedding present, you know, but she gave it. So that one, I guess she wasn't attached to those different things that they are attached to, yeah. It's good to check with the people.
I have a question. I'm struggling a lot with this giving and taking with my friends in particular and some family members.
Mm-hmm.
Remembering birthdays, Christmas, you know, all these holidays. And I don't want any gifts anymore. I've shared that with, I don't need anything. I'm in the process of getting rid of things and giving things away.
Mm-hmm.
I have no room in my life, you know. So I struggle with, you know, friends still wanting to do things for me for my birthday, and I don't want to say no, but then I feel like I have to return when their birthday comes up, and I don't even want to do that. I want to give to them, but not because it's their birthday.
Yeah.
Or it's Christmas. So I'm struggling a lot with that.
Okay, so the whole social thing about people doing things for us on our birthday and then us feeling obliged to do things for them on their birthday. I think when people want to do things on our birthday, we can say, you know, I really appreciate your good intention, but I would prefer not. Or you could say, I appreciate your good intention, and how about giving the money to a charity?
Mm-hmm.
And then you can tell them what charity you really like and say, you know, it'd be much more meaningful to me. This is a charity that I really believe in. If you gave the money that you would spend on a gift to this charity. And similarly, you know, if instead of giving them the fifth object that they already have that they don't need, you know, because they're of the same kind that they already have five and they didn't need the first one, it's so funny, isn't it?
You
have way too much. Is, you know, to give to a charity and have the charity send a card to your friend that a donation was made in their honor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very, very nice way to do it.
There's a couple of us that are trying to do that, but it's not always working.
Yeah.
But, yeah, thank you.
And you can't always please everybody. And sometimes you have to be, you know, then you have to decide, is it more important to you to please those people? Or is it more important to you that you do what you feel is the way you want to live? And then you make the decision about what's more important and accept the good and bad sides of either decision.
And there's many decisions in samsara, you can't have it both ways. Somebody is going to be unhappy with you. Give up trying to please others. Remember.